This talk is mostly alternative quantum gravity in a sense, but even though it's motivated by this, I will focus mostly on the scale of field, and then I will tell you just in words what are the results for gravity. And of course, for this audience, what I'd like to say is, what we do here is it's low energy, basically, alternative quantum effects. So I will never address any questions that are really relevant for quantizing gravity yet. What I really think why this is worth studying is because we do not really understand many aspects of quantizing gravity in Higgs backgrounds, which is essentially a low energy phenomenon, yet we do low energy observations. And in particular, the question I will address today, whether any of those perturbative effects, quantum gravitational perturbative effects, could have any effects on large scales, in particular on the evolution of the universe itself. And of course, to address this question, you need to understand whether these fluctuations that are generated by the expanding universe can have an impact on the evolution of the universe through calculating the corresponding stress energy terms. So I will, unfortunately, as nicely introduced, so this problem, this is an ongoing project, and I will not give you a definite answer today, so I'll basically just summarize my progress and also with my collaborators on certain aspects of this problem. And so this work is mostly based on this paper with Thomas Janssen, and also this one here in the last 5 minutes, which is now already published, with Richard Woodard and Shu Bengyang, and also from Janssen. And let me just begin with trying to explain roughly what we're trying to do here. So, of course, you have an Einstein equation, which I wrote here in particular in this form, and whereby this is Einstein tensor, stress energy tensor, which are functions of the metric tensor and matter fields. And I have I've decomposed here my metric tensor in the background and fluctuating B. So, the background means B, fluctuating B means delta, and similarly matter fields. And basically, if I ignore fluctuations, and this is what usually you do in cosmology, I mean 99.9%, then you get the background equations, and of course they have this familiar form. And of course, this background equation will give you, let's say, if you assume homogeneity, you get the Kilner orbits looping, you get black hole universe, etc. But of course, the question is, if I include those fluctuations, then they somehow will back react on the evolution of the background itself and give their own contribution. And this own contribution can be sort of parameterized by looking at the contribution of this guy here to the Einstein tensor, which you can call with index Q. And also these two guys as contributing the stress energy tensor, which you can call also with index Q, as opposed to the background contribution with B. And there is an additional complication. That is that these two contributions and fluctuations from matter fields and rotation fields actually, in general, couple. So it is not possible to separate completely the contribution coming from the rotation fluctuations from those coming from matter fluctuations. So it is therefore convenient to take them together and just put them together into one object, which I call T mu nu Q. Okay, so that's the object. Yes?
And can I ask a question? If you're writing states and operators, then we're in the canonical formalism. And the canonical formalism for the components of the Einstein equations have a different status than the other, that is, they're constraint equations rather than evolution equations. So shouldn't we treat those four differently at this stage? Since we're in the canonical formalism and taking expectation values about things.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure I understand the question. I mean, we should do constraint quantization. That doesn't answer your question.
Well, might we, for example, consider the G00 equation like the way that we consider Gauss's law and electromagnetism in the Magnus theory? I'm more wondering, we don't, when we do this kind of semi-classical gravity, we don't pay any attention to the fact that some of them are constraint equations and some of them are evolution equations.
I think one should, of course, pay attention, and one can. But the thing is, with most of my talk, I will actually not dwell on those type of questions, because I will work in the tunnel. But we could maybe discuss this more. I mean, I have a paper in preparation which in detail addresses this question. So it is not published yet. And so I think cosmologists are getting more and more aware that, of the fact that these equations, well, how the constrained equations should be treated.
I mean, I'm not sure we know the answer to how they should be treated, but I think I mean, the fact is that there are no states in the physical Hilbert space on which the constraints act with a non-zero action. But there are states where the other components of the Einstein equation act, which are non-zero.
With the perturbation theory, I think we know how to do that. That is the statement I would like to make. So, but of course, I think we should discuss it in private. You want to know this object T mu Q, and also you want to know whether this object can play any relevance in the evolution of the Bayesian equation. In other words, you want to make a comparison between T mu Q and T mu B. So how big they are. And not just at any given moment in time, but throughout the evolution of the universe. So my purpose of the talk is show how these two objects can be actually compared in a certain toy model. Now, one more caveat. The way you actually calculate this object here actually depends very much on how you choose the physical state. So, of course, in our universe, we know fairly, we have quite a lot of information what the physical state of our universe is. Nevertheless, this information is incomplete. And in particular, this object here, which is defined as the quantum operator minus the background taking interpretation value with respect to the physical state and similar such energy tensor. So this both of them actually depend very much on how you precisely define your physical state. So there is an ambiguity here. And what I'll argue today is this ambiguity is not an ambiguity in the sense that persists for the semi-classical Einstein interaction, but it's an ambiguity that can be resolved by fully specifying the physical state by certain set of actually measurements, in fact, which will actually tell us what the right physical state actually is.
So is this what you call semi-classical gravity, or
I think that's standard name, yeah. So where you quantize matter, well, actually. No, I think this is a bit more than semi-classical gravity, because in principle here I'm also quantizing the gravity.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm just thinking that maybe this is just a definition of background. So maybe it's this quite general, just how what you mean by background.
If I could solve this equation consistently, then I would have I would go beyond what I call semi-classical gravity. But of course, the problem is that in order to calculate this part, I would also have to calculate, solve separately the equation for the perturbations themselves. And that equation would have to be set consistently solved in the right background. So, in other words, I have a second equation which I have hidden here, which I didn't discuss at all at the moment, but I will discuss it also as time comes. And unfortunately, I will not discuss today how to solve fully and consistently these two equations for the background and for the fluctuations. And in a way, this is a future project. But I think before we actually go into discussing self-consistent solution for the background and fluctuation equation, we should first try to understand a very simple question, which is under what conditions we expect that this guy can become comparable or even bigger than the background part, so that the background action becomes important. And that is the main question I'll try to answer today. So therefore, this is the equation, this is the form weight. And of course, at the moment, I have some ideas how to so consistently solve the equation with the background plus fluctuations, even at one loop. But so far, as far as I know, there is not a single paper that's done that. And my work is also, to a certain extent, motivated by not just the problem of self-consistent evolution of the background in inflation, but also by the question of dark energy. And most of my talk, I will actually focus on the question of quantizing scalar field, and I'll completely switch off gravity. So gravity will be non-dynamic. And the reason I do this is because I don't want to burden you too many indices. We've done some work on gravity as well. So, but at the moment, I will really, for the purpose of my presentation, present the work in the scalar field, and then I'll make various statements about what actually happens with the graviton, most likely in this context. So, in order, yes? So I will assume this diagram.
So what am I teaming in? What's your definition?
Oh yes. The teaming new background will be the background of the scalar field and will have this form. So it has a perfect fluid form, and it can be obtained from from let's say scalar field,
yeah.
Homogeneous scalar field, yeah. Okay.
Yes,
okay.
Okay. All right. Diagram is defined by this extremely homogeneous.
Yes, it's a cosmological homogeneous diagram. Yeah. Any further?
So when you solve, so I don't know if I have a T-menu Q, it just be determined by extending the action and perturbations and varying.
Yes. One loop.
So, okay, so this is, can you just make, because at this level it just looks like it's a classical version. Try to stay at one loop.
Yeah, it's not classical, it's one. As that for my title.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the statement that dark energy can perhaps be explained, is that the coarse graining statement that if you first grain gravity, the claim is that you first grain gravity over small distances and then the effective description you get on long distances non accelerates, or what's the story?
No, the statement is that if what I define to be T medium Q, it can be comparable greater than T medium background, that means if I can get to the regime where the back reaction can become strong, then the equation of motion will suddenly change.
Doesn't that mean that you don't believe it's possible? So your inference that it's describing dark energy is a classical statement? In the sense that you're saying that I've got some sort of source and I put in Einstein's equations and I get acceleration?
What I'm saying is, I'm not making a statement this is the case. I'm making a statement this is something we should explore, this possibility. And the answer, it's a well-defined theory, and the answer can be either yes or no.
I mean, to me, what it sounds like what's going to happen is if you're in that regime, then the thing that's controlling your semi-classical approximation is failing. So that the classical approximation isn't going to be capturing it at all what the system really does.
Well, my one-loop approximation can indeed fail. And then in order to check, I would have to go through some utility methodology. But what I want to say is I would be very happy if I can only already solve self-consistent value equation. I would be very happy.
And for what you're saying, you don't rely on the background to be small compared to fluctuations. That's specifically for dark energy. So nothing you're going to say relies on the quantum effects dominating the background.
It does not rely on it, but I'm investing in that question.
I just want to see what happens.
Okay.
Can I just?
Sure.
There are two, supposedly two ways of describing the acceleration of the universe, or not acceleration of the universe. One is inhomogeneous universes, void that one. They have inhomogeneous structure for late time non-linearity, as opposed to dark energy. So in the first case, there is no dark energy. Second case, there is dark energy, lambda, cosmological force, etc. But here you have quantum fluctuations,
yes.
Not classical.
Yes.
Fluctuations.
Yes, I have
quantum. So you're claiming that the quantum fluctuations can produce an explanation for accelerated movements.
I'm just investigating the possibility, I'm not claiming.
Normally with T-million vacuum would be just call the quotation value of T-million be that vacuum, but that's not the case
It is the expectation value, yeah.
But the expectation value.
So it's this. That is what it is.
Right, but you're assuming T million Q is of the same order as T million Q.
I'm not assuming it more than anything.
Okay.
I want to calculate. Yes.
So even though I've been looking at these equations all my life, I'm completely confused as to what they mean. Is this meant in the context of the fact that field theory where there's a scale, or there's something like a renormalization or a cutoff scale, and we're describing an approximation which is good for wavelengths longer than that scale?
My intent here is to take account of all wavelengths.
I think we should let them
maybe it's going to become clear what I mean.
Okay. So it's not effect. So we can't think an effect of
the language. Maybe it's just a perturbative gravity. That's all.
But perturbative gravity is not one of
the in the infrared regime, I think it is. We have no evidence.
Which is equivalent to saying it's effect of field theory. And all the coupling constants are functions of the scale. So if you say that, I'm happy. If you say
yes,
you
yes,
say
but the thing is
quantum gravity, I don't know what you mean.
Cool. One loop.
It's still a function of the scale.
Yeah, but
you have to add.
But so it is true in ordinary field theory, things are functions of scale.
Yeah, absolutely.
What is the problem?
So I want to know I can think that way. So G is a function of scale.
Yes.
Lambda is
a function
of scale.
Yes. But I can fix this scale.
And is A squared there a function of scale?
You mean
so it is a coefficient in the
this?
Field theory.
No,
a function
no.
Of scale.
No.
But G and lambda are.
Well, true. Since A is in principle self-persistent, A would be a function of quantum, will be a function of solving an on-shell quantum equation in principle will be also.
But that on-shell quantum equation has a scale.
Yes,
so
therefore
the solutions are a function of scale.
That's true.
So A is also a function of scale.
True, yeah, but the thing is that you can actually RG improve the action and make it scale independent if you want to.
Right, if you do,
so,
that, do that, we can talk about it.
Yes. I mean, there is no reason why you don't do that.
Yeah, you have no objection to thinking in terms of effects of your point.
Yes. Okay, so let me try to move on. So I discussed most method is thermal, and I think it's well motivated to actually consider scalar field which couples to reach a scalar to this type of term. And reason is because you can actually compose a graviton into three such scalars, whereby each of them covers a different value of C. One of them is C equals zero, and the other two will be positive C. So keep that in mind. And then, of course, graviton is more complicated because there are all kinds of Lorentz indices floating around. And I don't have to worry about Lorentz indices here when I'm talking about scale. And the second thing is I will consider the homogeneous universe just as written here. So eta is conformal time. Eta mu nu is Minkowski metric. Constant distillation parameter Q equals epsilon minus 1, epsilon minus h dot of x squared. So this epsilon is nothing but the epsilon of slower inflation. And I'll assume epsilon constant. And so what it means is that, well, epsilon will be 0, but also epsilon is not necessarily small like inflation. It's an arbitrary parameter which is constant. So it's slightly different than Slorov approximation inflation, yet in the limit of time is small, and I can neglect epsilon dot to reduce Slorov inflation. Now, a few words on the cosmological constant problem. Just maybe you're not all familiar with some of the aspects of this question, and within the context I'm discussing, there are several questions that I think are worth addressing and have not been addressed in literature yet. Take, for example, Yukalov here, right? And so we have a scalar and we have a fermions, and add a cosmological term, and consider there is no range for the scale itself. Now, since in the Yukalov theory, fermions appear as quadratically in the Lagrangian, I can integrate them out. And I'll get a complicated and effective theory for the scalar, which will generate an effective potential for the scale. So this effective potential, if I now identify V0 with lambda, so this is the classical blue line is the classical result. When I now integrate out the fermions, I'll get the red curve. So this is how fermions feel integrated out C of fermions. Now, this is just fermions put in the vacuum. So this is vacuum contribution of fermions. And this result is actually true independent of whether you do it, for example, whether you integrate out fermions in the Minkowski space or integrate out in the sitter. But I cannot make any statements about what happens if I integrate out fermions in an arbitrary space-time. Let's say an arbitrary cosmological space-time, because I don't know how to integrate fermions in determinants. And I think this is precisely what should be done. Why? Because if I integrate fermions in the sitter space, for example, or Minkowski, this is sort of the curve that I get. So then naively you would say, I start here, my scalar field starts here, and then it's going to see that the theory is unstable, it's going to start run off, and it's going to run off into negative energy theory. And of course, the question is, does anybody know what happens if energy becomes negative? What happens?
Is that the million-dollar question?
Well, precisely. I mean, well, it is in a way a million-dollar question because you have to. The thing is, what happens here? As soon as you cross this, you will realize that the answer for the metric doesn't work anymore. So you have to change it somehow. I have my thoughts. I think I know actually how these answers for the metric tends to change. To accomplish this. But there is something else going on, and this is that this type of effective theory had been written in some fixed background, but of course, as the field rolls down, the background is changing, and I would like, every time that my background changes, I would like to recalculate my effective potential. And the question is, of course, what happens here, especially when you come close to zero? Locally, if this process were adiabatic, you would think, I know what happens. I go close to Minkowski space here. But this process is very non-adiabatic. I mean, it's not, there is no very simple answer to this question before. If you really could solve equations for fluctuations of consistency with the Langevin equation for the evolution of the universe, then only then you can really answer the question.
Isn't this at some level, I make this happen by dialing down lambda so that it's artificially small compared to typical classical numbers? And at some level, what you're doing is turning classical power term against the one limit correction, right? So, in that limit, wouldn't this just be the standard assumption people make when they say that there's a more normalization of the problem?
I don't think so. I really don't think, because this reduction of the cosmological constant here happens not because of the cosmological constant, but because of the potential associated with running scalar field. So it's a dynamical effect, and it's not a cosmological constant. It's really there when I write the equation for the field, just a classical equation with the scalar field with this effective, well, it's not a classical, with this effective potential, plus the Einstein's equation, again, classical with this effective potential, and I try to solve it consistently, then I would really get a solution. But the problem is, I actually don't know what the effective potential is.
So are the rules that at the classical level there was no potential? And it was just
exactly.
And so eventually
the rules are at the classical level there is only an effective potential in the system. And I know how to calculate.
You mean the constant potential?
No. This is the potential is generated. There is the sitter. So you're in the sitter background, you integrate out fermions in the sitter space. I don't have to do that. And then you get something like this.
But originally you could have some bare potential before integrating.
Sure, but for simplicity, I didn't. I just had one number.
And there's no phi squared arbitrary.
No.
So, the Higgs potential, you minimize, calculate vacuum density by taking the energy to the fourth power, and you get this horrible result, 10 to the power of 56, or times the observed vacuum density. So you don't you get an energy scale there that gives you an enormous cosmological constant?
Look, this is just a toy model of Ricardo theory, which is motivated by the Higgs. That's a Higgs electron system.
So that just makes sense. Higgs, standard Higgs.
So Higgs electron. I've simplified my standard model. I don't want to have all the complications of other fields. Also, I don't want to have a three-level potential. Nothing. Just because logical constant plus current. So anyway, I think this is one thing one should try to solve. So consistently, simply to know what actually happens when you run through the zero thing. Because it's not known. And second, of course, if you are now in theories which contain scalars and vectors, when you integrate them from a similar situation, static situation, we're generating the vector potential that is not stable. So here there is no actual stability problem. But also there is no, in that sense, there is no hope to solve the most constant problem in the same sense that there might be here.
So if you take the standard model, which type of curve you get?
I don't know. You see, the thing is some people calculated, this is the question of stability of the standard model, and which is a lot discussed in literature in Minkowski background. And people have actually taken this criterion that there is no runaway solution as material that constrains coupling in the standard model. And there are no trivial constraints coming from that.
But you have a master's scale.
Well, this is just a simple toy model that is motivated by the standard model.
The Higgs model gives a CCP because it has a max.
Sure.
And you raise that to the fourth power. And that's what causes this huge catastrophe. It's the Higgs mass that's doing it.
Yes, but you're talking about
the standard CCP problem.
Yes,
but
he's normalizing something.
I'm not
to be
here.
Lambda not at zero field, so he's normalizing away.
Yes, so you're talking about contribution to lambda coming from. Right, coming from either fermions or bosons.
Which is hugely low.
Look.
Any energy scale you get, well, it has to be raised to the fourth power to get the vacuum density.
Yes, but you see, what I'm talking about here is if this mass is generated by the excitation value of the Higgs, which in turn then is time dependent. So then you generate something that's time dependent. So anyway, what about, let me just now define my model. So my background space-time, as I mentioned already here, this is my metric tensor. These are my Friedmann equations, the background energy. So what I assume is my background has a form of perfect fluid, so you can get it by, for example, from scalar field. And I will not say anything else about the background, except that it has a form of perfect fluid, so it's specified by the energy density and the pressure. And it's homogeneous in space, but not in, but it's functional time. And it's also given by the equation of state parameter W background, which I will assume is constant. And now from the two Friedmann equations, you can actually divide one by this one by that one, you get epsilon, and epsilon expressed in terms of W. So my second Friedmann equation is actually epsilon is 3 half 1 plus W. And if W is constant, epsilon is as well. So in that sense, this sort of, in a way, I think it also justifies this approximation with the epsilon constant space. So whenever W, whenever the background is such that dominated by one species, let's say relativistic, then W is 1/3, epsilon is 2. Non-relativistic W is 0, epsilon is 3/2, etc., etc. So I have this simple situation. And of course, the scale factor is because it's time to power, also conformal time somehow. H now scales with epsilon is H minus epsilon. So the epsilon is positive, so it drops the time. And see, it's all this sort of power law scalings in this type of universe. Now I have a scalar field, and in a moment I'll define my theory. You see, I have a kinetic term, I have a coupling to which is scalar, and in principle you also have a potential term which I'll drop. And again, I'm motivated by the graviton, so I will not consider any potentials. In this situation, you can actually calculate at the one loop level. So this is the object. My quantum correction is just the stress energy insertion. And then I close it so it's in some common language, it's a one loop effect. So you can just get it, at least a trace of it. You can get by acting with the Laplacian operator on the Klingspor propagator. And the trace, of course, now the trace, well, actually, the stress energy tensor is defined in expectation value with respect to some physical states of some fluctuating field. Of course, the field is fluctuating wildly, so it has no symmetries per se. But if I take expectation value with respect to the physical state, which respects the symmetries of the background, then the propagator itself must obey its symmetries of the background. So that means that this object here will also have to obey its symmetries of the background. Likewise, the stress energy tensor will have to obey its symmetries of the background. Which means that I can actually, as long as I mean T mu q as a rotation line respect to physical state, such a quantum operator, I should be also able to write this in the perfect fluid form. So the only difference between the background and the quantum fluid now is that this letter B is now replaced by the letter Q. But otherwise, then.
I'm just trying to understand your trace coming thing. If I take C equals a 6, then that's the conformal scalar.
Yes.
So then that would be saying that T mu mu is 0. What about the trace now? What happened?
In the trace of T mu mu.
Yeah.
Yes.
Aren't you missing a counterterm piece in that?
Maybe.
Is it going to play important? Is it going to play a role when you go into
this? This is what you get as a result of the calculation.
Is he doing this on flat background or what?
It is a flat background, yes.
So flat background, then trace the
point. I think you're going to do the Sitter space.
No, it's the space with constant epsilon. It's more general. The Sitter corresponds to just epsilon equals 0.
But you're not specifying, you're not in flat space, right?
No, this is a general relation.
But I think the way
you're right. I mean, I don't know what happens to the normal again.
I think what you do is you derive that by taking the classical equation of motion, right? That the T mean
yes.
For that. But
yes,
that neglects the counterterm piece, which must somehow must fix the day. It's like an unnormalized statement as opposed to a normalized statement.
I think you're right. Yeah. maybe we should actually try to correct for this. So if I make this assumption here, then I have a pressure, quantum pressure, and quantum energy density. So trace is just minus rho plus p, and this is a scalar coincidence that has propagated coincidence. And of course, also this object itself, and just like in this object, this satisfies conservation of energy equation, and Jimmy satisfies the attribute. Therefore, this also must satisfy conservation equation equation, which I wrote this way. So from this equation here, you can actually derive rho q and pq from tq up to an integration constant. And this integration constant actually is nothing but the radiation scale. So I cannot determine by this procedure any component that scales, any contribution that scales 1.8 to the 4. Because that one will not contribute to Q. So but to that caveat, this procedure works.
So that's
Just the matter part is quantized. So I'm not at the moment quantizing gravity.
But it's not really consistent because, I mean, there is the Einstein frame versus Jordan frame, and you can mix a scalar with the a scalar with a scalar degrees of freedom of the gravity. And is it meaningful to say that you quantize one and don't quantize the other?
Maybe not. But as I said, this is more symptomatic. So in principle, I should also put this down. And again, I'm emphasizing that I can describe the graviton as a scale of sigma amount of C. So it's a sum of three types of scale. Okay. So this is for you who are not familiar with this. That much, so the this is the equation of motion for the scalar, and it turns out that the Ritter scalar in this space has particularly simple form. So R is given by 6,
we have more work
2 minus epsilon h squared. So in this case, when epsilon is constant, I can actually solve this equation.
I want to say if you run out of board, the are these boards.
At this level, since we are only interested in quadratic part of Lagrangian, I can actually quantize the field. So the standard decomposition in terms of creation relation operator works, where this one's actually not in the vacuum. And so these are the mode functions, which are functions of time. And for constant epsilon spaces, so for the background I just discussed here, I can actually solve this equation. And I can express my solution in terms of Hankel functions. And these are the Bobolinko coefficients. Let me just remind you that the standard choice advocated by, let's say, Bill Davis and 99% of the equation literature corresponds to alpha equals 1 and beta equals 0. But in general, this is not, they are not limited to that choice. The only constraint in alpha and beta is this one, so alpha square minus beta square is 1. So that means that there is one phase here that is in alpha and beta that is unphysical. That means I still have one amplitude to choose here and one phase in beta, which are physical choices. So there are two parameter classes of vacuum or state that you can actually choose still within this class of Q states. And the new parameter, at least in 4D, is given by 1/4 plus this combination. Now you see how this C and epsilon enter here. Epsilon enter is a very non-perturbative way. So this is the 1 over 1 minus epsilon squared. And of course, this constant, since now I assume that epsilon is constant, you can see that I have to assume that silence constant, otherwise this would not be a solution. And also when C is 1/6, then you just recover conformal vacuum from mu 1/4, mu 1/2. When C is 0, and epsilon is 0, you recover mu 3/2, which is flex spectrum. So that's the De Sitter result. And everything else is just some more general cases in between, or not just in between. So these are many possible cases being discussed here. And the fact that I allow for different choices of outcome data than discussed in Leslie Hill Davis and most classical literature is very important and will be also addressed in a minute. So, but the same equation, almost the same equation as for the one-point function also applies for the propagator. So this is my final propagator, which therefore has a delta function as a source. So, but otherwise the operator is the same. And of course, I'm now solving with B equals 0. And so again, this is the equation. And if I was naive, and at some point I guess I was, in my first paper that I wrote on this, so you would write the solution this way. This is an exact solution of this equation. At least it seems like in D dimensions, these space-time dimensions. So you can express the solution in terms of the hypergenetic functions. And the normalization is the so-called Hadamard normalization that is also uniquely fixed by the fact that there is a delta function source. So everything is here uniquely fixed, up to some homogeneous part here that I will not discuss. Now, this is the genuine vacuum propagator, and the Y here is the is invariant function, which is actually related to L, which is the simple invariant distance between two points. So in the Sitter space, this is very, very much a clear physical meaning. So this Y is very, it's just a rescaled invariant distance. But in constant time of space, there's no such thing. So it's not something. And this propagator actually, even though it's an exact solution to this equation, it's not a physical propagator. In fact, it's a nonsense propagator.
With Ken Hamilton Rain, there was a one-parameter family of solutions corresponding to the freedom to choose a one-parameter family of Sitter vacua.
Yes. So here I'm choosing alpha equals one beta z.
So this is the bunch Davies.
Bunch Davies, yes. And because I don't know how to solve when alpha is when beta is not zero, I don't know how to solve the fraction.
That's the solution, isn't it?
Sorry.
But that is a solution. So.
Well, yes, but not for the propagator. See, the propagator is partial x is prime.
We have a solution for one parameter family of solutions like this involving hypergeometric functions.
Well, constant alpha and beta.
Which I think it captured the full set of decision variant propagators.
Constant alpha and beta, not functional k.
It was the Sitter space.
Yeah. This is much. So this new is much bigger class of spaces. Okay. And moreover, as I said, I put the index infinite here, which I so what actually happened here, and d-dimensional regularization actually what it does, it's actually automatically constructs a solution where it's meaningful. And this solution is meaningful in certain number of dimensions where infrared is regulated. However, if d equals 4, infrared actually is not well regulated, and this propagator will just analytically continue from those dimensions where infrared is finite to those dimensions which where infrared is just not well defined. And any possible divergences that appear in the infrared, in particular those that are power-like, they will just automatically subtract by this propagator. So this propagator will not capture any possible infrared problems in the theory. And you will be fooled to believe that the infrared is meaningful by actually using this propagator. What this propagator maintains, however, this propagator maintains certain infrared problems of the type that corresponds to the divergences because they are not automatically subtracted by dimensional normalization. So I can in fact use this solution if one actually adds those terms that A plus theory that happens automatically subtracted by this solution. Alternatively, which is what I'll advocate here, is that one actually has to make a non-trivial choice for alpha and beta, which will regulate the inference on the property in a certain sense.
Wouldn't the party line be that if you calculate a physical observable, it will be inference, eh? It's that the infrared divergent pieces that are coming from a particular part of the calculation will cancel in the final answer, so it won't make a difference when you handle that part of the property?
My statement, maybe that's a part of the line, but I'll tell you what my statement is. This cannot be the physical choice of time, because it will lead to infinite. If you calculate observables as expectation values with respect to that object, you will get infinite quantities. Which means that this simply means that that pattern is unphysical. That's the statement I'm making. So whatever the pattern line is, I think the way you formulated it, it doesn't agree with what I'm saying.
Well, I guess, so the question would be, what thing was it that emerged? Was it really observable? Was it like an energy answer?
Yes, that's what I claim. Yes.
So you're thinking like phi squared or something like that?
Yes. It does contribute. I mean, if you trust this relation, it will contribute. So what I'll discuss today is this procedural matching, which
you're saying just one loop energy density.
Yes.
So then there could be divergence, or the higher loop may have maybe divergence as well, and all of them may cancel. Yeah. So.
No. They cannot cancel. Higher loop divergence cannot cancel the lower loop divergence. I'm sorry. I don't think so. They appear in different order in the coupling parameter.
But they're all infinite.
Sorry?
If they are all infinite, they can cancel.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think I agree with you, Steve, on Shaggy's vacuum. You know, you get infinite case, but there's a good argument for training like this ergo and the sitter. Like just for a free variable, usually you take the momentum or the position and you treat that differently, and then you treat all your other modes in the usual one to be first.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think like just in your ergo.
That's maybe an alternative approach. So the approach I'm looking at, there's also a Parker's approach, which I don't, which is sort of orthogonal to what I'm saying here. Because Parker's approach in collaborators is actually saying that this is just a mathematical divergence that has to be subtracted by some premiumization scheme. That's not the approach I'm taking here. The approach I'm taking here is that this is a physical divergence. This is a divergence caused by the wrong choice of vacuum state in the theory. So our physical state of theory cannot be bunch based. And of course, this is one possible way of choosing the vacuum that is not that bunch based. So you say that the universe starts in a radiation era, which gets the time equals 2 and completely regular infrared. Then you match it onto a state that is a time equal constant. And due to the procedure of matching, the epsilonical constant space will inherit the infrared properties of the radiation era through the non-trivial alpha and beta coefficients. So this is what I'm going to discuss in the rest of my talk. Alternatively, you can put the universe, let's say, in a common box with periodic boundary conditions. And that's a proposal done. There's been a lot of work on science computer. But this is what I'll advocate today, and it's related to the work also by maybe 20 years old by going forward. So since I don't know how to do any better, ideally, you see, I would like to do the matching which is smooth, and that is actually generated by some scalar field. The scalar field evolves in such a way from sample 2 to some sample constant universe. But since I don't know how to solve the equation for motion, for the fluctuations in this diagram, I'll do the Simon action. Because I know how to do solution here, and I know how to do solution there, and I know how to do matching. The more matching solved, this is why I do this. But this is not harmless. There are problems in Simon matching approximation. And the problem is the following. This radiation era contains only quadratic divergence in the ultraviolet, which is automatically subtracted in the measure of localization. But after the matching, there is another divergence which is logarithmic type that appears. So in other words, I need another constant to come here, which is pure consequence of the standard natural approximation. And so, of course, I don't like it very much, but I think I understand, I'm pretty convinced I understand that this is just constant standard natural. Basically, what you're doing here, you're actually changing an effective mass state fluctuation suddenly, and that corresponds to changing the total energy of the system that is by making demand. You need another counter term to actually make everything finite. And there are a couple of other problems with this, which are less involved, which I also understand. So I will not discuss it.
So then the divergence, you talk about the IR divergence?
Yes, ultraviolet. And ultraviolet divergences are just the long ones in some way.
So you said the radiation error also has a divergence?
Well, the property is a coincidence. So, you know, the momentum space twice per spectrum goes as k squared, right?
So, okay, so it's a UV divergence.
It's quadratically divergent. Okay. So, what I'm doing here is we want to do an honest, you know, regularization in the ultraviolet and then calculation what's left over in the infrared. And maybe I want to make a very important remark here that I don't have on the sciences, which is often missed in literature. Yes, but these are just eigen fluctuations, man. And people usually say, oh, the effect I can renormalize away simply by saying the T-mu from this quantum guys goes as some G-mu and the lambda, basically. So I can absorb them in my definition of lambda. But this is actually true for those parts of matter fluctuations whose momentum or even better energy is much later in age. So that I can write those as an integral for momentizing a half. So as long as I can do this, so for this part, indeed, this type of procedure works. But for the infrared guys, the form that the infrared fluctuation contributes to the stress energy tensor is not anymore proportional to the metric tensor, and this subtraction scheme simply doesn't work. So instead, what I have to do is I have to write it in this way, and I have to treat it as a pressure fluid. So this is my point.
In the end of the day, when you choose beta to be non-zero, you're going to do that for all k, right? It's not going to be, and you're building that in with the sediment approximation because you're saying that if there had been some scale associated with the transition, normally k's that were higher than that would be adiabatic, and
Exactly. So sediment approximation induces this volume divergence. But in sediment approximation, I can solve everything. So. And I'm still solving exactly for the moments. And the problem is now, of course, I would like ideally to get off coincidence propagator, calculate stress energy tensor, but I cannot do this. The best I can do is calculate on coincidence propagator. That's the best I can do. And this is what we managed to do. And with this, we actually could calculate by the procedure outlined before contribution to stress energy. But let me just spend 1 minute to outline what the infrared problem actually is. If you're in the city space, this is the well-known spectrum. So this is k squared, which is just the conformal part, so it's also present here in the vacuum. And this one comes from the application of vacuum fluctuations. And this is the city spectrum for scale fluctuations with c equals u in the city space. So we have this as a function of k, the spectrum, so k squared part and the amplified part, k zero. So this is the flat spectrum. And of course, the infrared problems are because the spectrum here has already been divergent. So this is the problem I'm talking about. So I have to regulate this infrared gradient somehow. And it gets worse if I'm in space time with a time between 0 and 3 halves. So that means the time of 0 is cyclic, but this is now worse. Because if I do the same calculation, coincident propagator in infrared, I'll see that this is the form from you. If I look at this, this will lead to an infrared divergence for any epsilon between 0 and 2 half. And that corresponds to any background pressure that is negative. So whenever pressure on the background is negative, I'm in trouble. I have power, not mass, power, which my propagator on several pages before, this propagator does not capture that power. So it simply automatically subtracts. So I have to take into account this divergence not common. And my matching radiation inflation actually does precisely that. And when C is not zero, then the simpler condition here actually becomes the shaded area instead. So something funny happens when R is, when epsilon is 2, that's radiation in R is 0, right? Of course, there is no divergence there. But when epsilon is greater than 2, then you see R is negative. So the effective mask, CR, becomes, positive chosen C becomes negative. So you see fluctuations experience negative mass in the shaded region. And likewise, here, fluctuations experience negative mass in the shaded region. And that is the origin of this neutral divergence coming from. So it is not, it's the physical divergence that is generated by a huge amount of amplification, and therefore by a huge amount of infrared correlations generated in such space times. So this is not, it's not a, in that sense it's not a job, it's a serious problem. And but as I said, the statement is that this matching here that I propose actually resolves the question in the following way, that these infrared divergences can build up, and they build up with time. So they need, they can never grow infinite, they grow finitely, they grow as power law. So they build up as power law, and after time, after time, they will be still finite. So in this sense, this matching actually regulates it. But this infrared eventually, you know, starts building up. And the question is whether the infrared is ever dangerous. And this relation here is the quantum equation of state parameter for the quantum fluid and for the background fluid. So this is the main equation you should remember in this talk. So what this equation tells me is that if this is satisfied, then I will have the quantum fluid scaling to be slower than the background scale. And if that happens, then I know this situation will be true. So this logarithmic scale factor of energy density. So the background density will scale faster than the quantum density. Eventually, the quantum density will become important and can dominate the evolution of that. So what we want to investigate in the rest of my talk is when this actually happens. And I will not bother you with our calculation, which is actually quite non-trivial. I will just present the results. So let's first consider the case when we are at the, well, at the boundary of this stability region. Right? And so what happens is, this is just my second trivial equation written in this way. So this is W versus epsilon. So it's just a straight line. And of course, when epsilon is 3 half, W is 0, etc. Which is here. When epsilon is 0, W is minus 1, which is 6. And the blue line is actually the quantum fluid equation state parameter. As long as the blue is above red, we have no problem. As you see here, we indeed have no problem. So I would say tick, this is a good result. So quantum can never grow faster than the classical on this machine. But now let's make to this take constant positive C. You see, there's something special about small C, and also something special about very large C here. But we are now in the regime of constant and small C. And again, you see this blue line is safely above the red line, so no problem. But however, when C grows big enough, after epsilon equals 2, something funny happens. The green line goes below, and this is the region when quantum parts get slower than the classical parts, so eventually we dominate. So again, now we've reached the conclusion, well, we've reached now the condition WQ is less than WB. And so here we are in this situation. That this can happen. And of course, the reason is basically here the mass acts as a as a negative mass, because the epsilon is greater than 2, r is negative, so this is the mass is negative for the effect fluctuation. This is why it's coming.
But you said mass is positive of the.
No, here, after, here the effective mass is negative for positive c. Because r is negative. C is positive, but r is negative. So it actually changes, completely changes after epsilon equals 2. And finally, when c is negative and small, this blue is small and green is the bigger, negative. You see, you're always in trouble when epsilon less than 1. Epsilon less than 1 is accelerated universe, that means that's inflation. So the quantum will always scale slower than the classical. So it will eventually be negative. And between 1 and 2 for epsilon, so this part of epsilon is actually negative pressure, this is positive pressure. And this is radiation, and this is curvature of the energy. So in this region, well, it can be either, you know, there's this critical value where the blue line crosses the red line, which is given here. So it can be this crossing can be anywhere between 1 and 2. So this is now the question whether quantum can become important or not. It really depends on the detail. Because the full lines cross. But anyway, so you see, for example, in C is minus 0.5, the crossing is actually above a positive pressure already. So this guy will actually become dominant. The quantum part can dominate even in matter. It's easy enough.
So phi is rolling down the is it not fixed?
No. Phi is just fluctuating, nothing else. My background fluid can be realized by phi, of course, but I don't care what's realized. It can be realized by some matter. Doesn't matter.
So you have some other matter in addition.
All I have about the background is that it satisfies the fluid equation.
Are you assuming that phi is constant in background? It's not.
Assuming in this derivation that phi is the zero there.
So when the mass becomes negative, effective mass becomes negative, shouldn't that induce that, you know, it's going to have a negative mass square, so it's going to more go down inverse potential?
Well, I mean, it's just the same as scalar multiple derivations.
No, but I think it's fine if the perturbations have a negative mass. But I'm just saying your background assumption that phi was constant. Now it's an unstable solution.
Okay.
And the mass is negative.
No, that's a good point. So we have not taken that into account. But if this scalar is not the graviton, then I don't think that. You see, you can also, if epsilon changes, what was this type of curve can switch into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just thought of it. So I'm just maybe, I think all the part where the effective mass is positive, so then the background is just phi being a constant, that's what the other case.
Yeah, we'll have to include that, but I just don't see that. I mean, this guy would also just contribute as addition to fluctuation. I mean, not. I don't see the code link.
But the input cause is the phase transition. As soon as the mass square becomes negative, you have a phase transition. There are places where phi is a little bit negative, it falls one way. If it's a little bit positive, it falls another way. And you're going to have domain balls. And
yeah, so we'll probably have breakdown of homogeneity.
Yeah.
Well, since you said phase transition, I mean, the whole thing, the way you're describing it, makes see if you had a mass in the original calculation, your infra divergence would have become a 1 over m squared and phi squared, right? So it sounds very much like a power law of infra divergence. And if you kind of think of it in non-gravitational examples, what do you do with infra divergences? There's the infrared thing in the QED, which if you find an infra divergence, you're thinking about the wrong observable, because the theory is basically making sense. But then this power law divergence sounds more like finite temperature field theory when you're near a critical point. Because when you dial a mass to be very close to zero, because it's the Bose-Einstein distribution functions all have 1/k's, it's more infrared singular than it was in zero temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, the power law divergences are really saying that you lose control over mean field theory that critical point, and you should kind of calculate there in the single classical approximation. So in the particle physics language you're using here, that would be a failure of classical approximation. So if that's what's going on, it should be possible to power count. If you kind of ask what's controlling loops in this effective field theory, if you're thinking of as effective field theory, that series should be failing for you at the point where it's passes. Do you know if that's, has that been thought through? Is that
Why massless? For massless thing,
your infrared divergence is telling you something, and then normally telling you something physical, and in the case, the finite temperature case, what it was telling you is that you're only really getting infrared divergences if you're kind of doing the semi-classical expansion around some assumed mean value, which
yes.
is, and that's the thing that's failing, because if you're yes. getting divergences, but you're not really getting the whole answer, you're neglecting things that are as important as what you're keeping.
Yeah.
If you actually could do the whole thing numerically, say,
yes.
then you don't get the problem.
Exactly. I completely. So I think that actually brings us back, I think, to what I was trying to say in the beginning of my lecture, is that ideally we want to solve circumsistently equations for the background infrastructures. And at the moment, I have not done that. All that I've done here is design a criterion which tell us in what case the background, the fluctuating part can become important, and therefore, in that situation, in order to really answer what happens dynamically, I would have to solve these three questions.
Okay.
But I'm saying, well, for example, here, you don't have to bother, because quantum part in this regime scales faster. Initially, the transition at the matching point was small, remaining a smaller fraction of the background part. So why should I bother with solving this? But for example, at this point, or in particular, in all of this regime here, I certainly have to worry about it. So that's the message of my talk. So now I can tell when the quantum part is actually important.
Well, modulo, the issue that you're making your emphasis based on a semi-classical analysis. And so one thing you could ask, you could imagine one or two things happening. One is that the fluctuations in the scalar field are important, but somehow the gravitational part of it stays semi-classical, and then what you'd be doing would make sense, it sounds like. And then you're kind of doing a self-consistent picture with quantum field. But it could also be the whole semi-classical picture, including gravity scale. And so it'd be nice to know which of those is going on.
Yeah. Well, let's discuss this later. So one other cut. One other remark is, I said I will be telling you something about the graviton. What we've done with the graviton, we've done analysis, which I'm discussing now, also in common remarks. And so in order to determine WQ, you just have to determine the leading order of behavior of this energy, because it's a power law in some time dependent parameters. So it's a series of where the powers are sort of decreasing in some small parameter or increasing. Right? And so this criteria of what I define as WQ is a late time asymptotic behavior that I'm talking about. Only one term dominates, and all the other terms are subdominant. It turns out that if you actually do the same type of analysis in common box, that the actual asymptotic behavior, at least in accelerating universes, depends upon the mismatching and common box, whereby I do identify the Hubble parameter matching with my infrared current box in this way. Now, having said that, that means that certain results after some numerical prefactor, which differs, can be carried over directly from this matching analysis onto this common box analysis. And we have done enormous calculation of graviton in common box, also this one loop. And indeed, basically, we confirm this program as well. And another caveat, as I said, the differences actually do arise here. Because what happens when the Kolmogorov box enters the horizon, then actually there are differences that arise. Because there is a physical periodic universe that you actually see the boundaries of. that you're discussing, and of course, this is not what happens in this picture. So then the differences arise. Okay, so this is now finally the two regions where now you can see between C0 and 1/3, for any epsilon, there is no this condition. This is just the region where conditions WQ less than WB. And so in this region, you actually small c, you never see. For accelerating universe, whenever c is negative, you have this condition is met. And also for this region, c is negative enough. And also here, for c greater than 1/3, you have also a region where this condition is met. So this is sort of the main result sometimes. And let me just so some words of possibility that this has anything with dark energy. Of course, this requires further investigation. Let me just summarize. So this is just what I've done here is, of course, very incomplete. And I think the results are interesting enough to motivate further study. And of course, this inferiorization. I believe it's physical, but it's not the only one. So, of course, you can actually, for the scale theory, you can have a master and certain will regulate theory, but not for the graviton. So that doesn't work for the graviton. But if you put everything in a positive curved universe, that would nicely work both for the graviton and the scale. So this is actually my favorite way of regulating the theory. And, but unfortunately, we cannot solve the mode equations. In this case. So the progress is difficult in this case. And final box is, of course, also something I mentioned. Now, non-costed epsilon space is also higher loops. That's also important to include and understand. What about the fermions? You've seen the fermions are also interesting. They can give you this upside down potentials in color theory. And of course, you would like to also know what happens when the time is changing and try to self consistently solve those equations really. And there's another question which I haven't discussed at all, which is the question of the gauge choice in the graviton. So far there is only one for the graviton in constant epsilon spaces. There's the graviton you can construct only one case for one gauge, which has been done by myself and Thomas Janssen. So the question is, of course, what happens if graviton and other gauges? So one can construct the propagator of graviton and other gauges. Well, it's a different story. And nobody's done that yet. So as you see, there's a lot of things one would have to do, you know, to really better understand this question. And I promised you something else, but given that I lost a lot of there are lots of questions, so I'm not saying anything else. I'll just say maybe one sentence. And what we did in this other paper was to actually look at something which we call Hubble effective potential, which is an effective potential construction in spaces where the field actually rolls, depending on the field's function of time. And that's appropriate for cosmological spaces. So one should basically forget Coleman Weinberg and use our effective potential. Okay.
We have time, one very pressing question.
Just tell about the question and let you advertise your last thing there. So, is your short version of your improved effect potential that if you did Coleman Weinberg with the Sitter propagators, then you'd get your answer? Is that more or less what you're improving?
No.
No,
I'll ask you this. It captures that property that captures one of the three aspects of our effective extensions. Only one of three.
Okay. So the next talk will be upstairs in 10 minutes. So that gives us enough time to get a break. And so that'll be Mark Esper starting in 10 minutes in the bar. Okay.